Yeah. And yo, Black, it's time.
Word.
It's time, man. It's time, man. All right. Begin.
I got to talk. I got to tell what I feel. I got to talk about my life as I see it.
Ladies and gentlemen.
I like to know.
Are you ready for start time?
Yeah. Okay, well, let me kind of move these things around here, you know.
Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know what this is coming down through the audience, but look like he just came out of the basement.
You know what I'm saying?
Thank you, because now...
Get ready.
Yeah. We dedicate this to these people out here getting ranked.
Because only one thing counts in this life. Get them to sign on the line which is dotted.
And I own this $500 million shiny suit.
Looking like a bag of money.
Because you drove a Hyundai to get here tonight. I drove an $80,000 BMW. That's my name.
You see this watch? That watch costs more than your car. I made $970,000 last year. How much you make?
Somebody in the house say yeah. If y'all really like to rock the funky beats, somebody in the house say hell yeah. I like that for the people up top. Check this out.
A, B, C. A, always, B, B, C, closing. Always be closing. Always be closing. If you want to work here, close.
Okay, I'm reloaded.
From the sports bars to the stands, we are the voice of the fans. You are now plugged into the Section 357 show, the sports mixtape, aka the Ball Street Journal. And you're hanging out with your Ball Street Journal reporters, D, Floyd, and Ronnie. I'm Floyd, D and Ron. How are you guys doing?
Doing absolutely fantastic. Got another great show out there for the fans. As we do on the Ball Street Journal, we're never afraid to shy away from some of the touchier topics that are out there. In a previous show, we talked about the WNBA and women's sexuality in sports. And in this show, we've got another touchy subject that you won't hear about touched on many other sports talk shows. So with that being said, Let me turn it over to my man who has never once in his life sold out. My man Ronnie, how you doing?
I'm doing well. We're going to talk about racism in sports, you know, different examples all over the place, sort of a potpourri of sports and racism this week on the Section 357 show. But when we talk about racism, we got to talk about my main man, Floyd. He's accepted everywhere he goes. What's going on, man? How's everything on Camelton Road? How's everything in Cambodia?
I'm feeling good, feeling great, guys. Always a pleasure and a privilege to have this conversation and to share that with our fans. This is the Section 357 show. Check us out on Twitter at Section 357, as well as your other social media destinations. Guys, anytime you talk about race and sports, it gets touchy, as D said. But before that, what kind of sparked this conversation was a song. And by now, most of you have heard the LL Cool J, Brad Paisley, Accidental Racist song. That was sort of what kicked off this conversation amongst the crew when it comes to race and sports. So without spending too much time in that song, we're going to talk about that later, but let's use that as a good stepping stone for this conversation. When you talk about race and sports, one of the sports that's having a really big problem with that right now is English football in a variety of ways. But most recently, the Ferdinand brothers were the subject of an investigation as it relates to whether they were dealt some racist chants in a recent match. The FA deemed that there was no racism. And that brings me to my point when it comes to this particular episode, or this particular scenario, if you will. A governing body will always have a hard time identifying things like racism. If you have a situation where folks in the stands are chanting racist things, if you're going to really stamp that out, it has to be the folks in the stands policing themselves. A governing body will never be able to stop that more effectively than the folks in the stands themselves. Guys, what do you think about that?
I think what makes this case interesting in another level is that the Ferdinand brothers, who were the alleged targets of this racism, have been two guys who have not exactly been all aboard with race, anti-racism campaigns in England, especially Anton Ferdinand. He did not participate in the handshake gesture a couple months back in the season. Real Ferdinand has been someone who has not really, who has felt like he's more been kind of used as a pawn. They tried to use him as a pawn in the game. So how much that played into, I'm not sure. But I think what's interesting about this, Floyd, is that what is the real answer for a governing body? Because to me, I don't know what the punishment is going to be. Do you close stadiums off? Do you give teams a super huge fine for what is a pretty small percentage of the fans? Not only is it hard to pinpoint, but what is the punishment? Because I'm not a big fan of punishing the masses for a small number.
I agree with you there, Roddy. I do think that the governing bodies need to experiment with punishments until they find out what works. And I say that because, Floyd, I just don't think that the fans are going to be strong enough to police themselves. There's always that vocal minority that's out there. One of the great things about soccer is that it's such a global game, so you have different teams and different ethnicities playing in different countries, so you're always going to run into those clashes. But I wonder if really penalizing the team in terms of the outcome will help. You know, fans are very passionate, and at the end of the day, they're not going to want to hurt their team. So if you can take away points somehow, if you can levy massive fines, I don't know, remove players from the pitch. I don't know what it's going to take, but I do think that the governing bodies need to look at a bunch of options and, more importantly, need to have their eyes and ears open and recognize what's obviously taking place in the sport.
I want to ask you about that, D. D, you say that, and we all say that, football slash soccer is a global game. But in a lot of European countries, are the communities that these games are being played in, are they diverse? Are they as global looking, if you will, as the product on the field? Because I would go out on a limb, a short limb, and say that when you have racist chants like that, in my mind, you have a very homogeneous crowd that bands together to do that. I can't see it being a very diverse crowd that would start those kinds of chants. And I bring it back to how we deal with things in the States. If you go to an NFL game, there are probably racist people around you of all walks of life at that game. But there's enough respect for the game, and there's enough respect of your fellow person near you to say, I'm not going to say certain things to that player or to you in the stands because, A, it might get handled very physically in the stands among the fans themselves, as well as the police or the facility marshals who are there to kind of take care of things like that. So in the States, with as many racial problems as we still have here, those types of things are not tolerated because the fans will police themselves.
Well, Floyd, we did mention this off-air before, and you were the one that pointed it out to me when I noticed that the crowds in a lot of these games were, like you said, not very diverse. And your point, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, was that going to these major soccer events at times can be very cost prohibitive, and that can keep a lot of people out, more so than sporting events are expensive here in the States. But to clarify my earlier point, I agree with you that certainly in the Premier League you can see stands that don't have a lot of diversity in them. I guess my point was, though, is that you have teams made up of multinational players that don't always end up playing up where they're based at. So, in other words, you see Manchester City sometimes playing outside of England or playing outside of Europe. And so that's where you can start to see some problems with fans that you never expected.
I think one of the other issues that you have in world football, not just the premiership, and we'll talk about them today, is that in America, while you have international players in our league, it is still very much Major League Baseball, NBA, NFL. It is still a very heavy American player league. Now, you have different races of players, but pretty much the mass majority of the league is still from America. Whereas if you look at the premiership, France, Germany, even Spain, you could have a team where half your starters or more are not from the country that they're playing in. You can have teams. I remember Arsenal a few years back lined up like six Afro-French players at one time in a game. And I think the racism part, not justifying it, is you see a lot of frustrated fans who feel like these foreigners have come over to our country. They're taking over our pastime. They're taking over our club. We had the incident with Zenit St. Petersburg where basically they said, we want no African descent gay players on the team. I think that's the biggest difference between the two sports is we're still a very much Americanized, we're still a very American-heavy league. A lot of your football league and football clubs are not heavy nationalistic, are not heavy in that particular country as far as the makeup of the roster.
Well, Ron, let me bring this back to you then and talk about baseball, because baseball is probably the one sport where you have a very large percentage of non-American players, especially when you look at players from the Dominican Republic, Venezuela, a lot of Spanish-speaking countries. So, Ron, how do you think baseball handled that Latin takeover, if you will? I don't want to characterize it in that term, but just for the sake of conversation. How do you think baseball handled that large influx of foreign players? Because I would guess that there will be certain people in the States who would think the exact same thing, that these Spanish-speaking players are taking over our team, our pastime.
I think the one thing Major League Baseball has done well as far as its marketing and branding is that they've embraced the Latino community in the sport. ESPN Deportes covered the World Baseball Classic. ESPN Deportes covers baseball games in Spanish. They recognize the heritage, the history, and the tradition of the Latin-speaking people so that they accommodate that group. So, yeah, while you probably have people in the stands who don't like seeing a team of Gomez and Sanchez and Reyes, Major League Baseball has made an initiative to embrace that side. Football has done nothing to embrace other cultures except telling people don't be a racist. They don't celebrate like an African-American History Month the way we do over here, or Latino History Month in football. All they just tell people there is just don't be a racist. They have that actually embrace these other cultures.
On top of that, I would even argue that the NBA has had their Hispanic Heritage Nights or celebrations where they have the jerseys. You see Los Heat or things of that nature, Los Lakers on the jerseys. And let's move to the NBA, because in a recent conversation on 60 Minutes, Jeremy Lin talked about his path to the NBA and taking what he perceived, you know, as some racist shots along the way, whether it was about his skin color, his height, his ethnicity, whether it was playing basketball in California, to not getting a scholarship offer, to not getting drafted. So when you look at a Jeremy Lin, someone who is an above average guard in the NBA, could you make the case that racism or a stereotype or some intermingling of those two played a part in him not getting a scholarship in basketball at the college level, as well as not getting drafted.
I'm not familiar enough with Jeremy Lin's performance in high school and going into college, so I don't know how much of a star he was and how well recruited he was. But from what I've seen, you said, Floyd, that he's an above-average NBA player. He is good, but he's not great. And I really think that his play on the field made more of an impact on his lack of being recruited than his ethnicity. That being said, I'm sure that there was a lot of doubts about any potential that he might have shown due to his ethnicity. You don't think of Asian American basketball players as being a dominant force, for lack of a better term. So I'm sure there was some underlying doubt that was due to his ethnicity, but I think it was his play on the field that ultimately did him in.
Well, D, let me just jump in there to clarify things real quick. As far as I recall it, Jeremy Lin was the equivalent of Mr. Basketball in California coming out of high school. He was the player of the year in high school coming out of California when he was about to go into college. So that's one thing. Not to say that that means he's the best player. So to speak, he was still voted that honor, whatever that means to you. As it relates to him playing at Harvard, he led Harvard in points, rebounds, assists, and steals. So, again, if you're an above-average NBA player, that means you're probably a pretty good college player, just as it relates to the level at which you're playing. So most above-average players at the professional level were stars or at least star-worthy in college. But I just wanted to add my two cents as it relates to that. So, Ron, go ahead.
I guess my point is, Floyd and D, is the timing of the release of this piece, because this was a much more relevant story a year ago when it was Lin's sanity, it was New York, he was having legitimately big games in the NBA, and he was kind of the sensation. And now they pull this out a year later when he's in Houston, and if you've been following the NBA this year, you know he's having a good year. But James Harden is the overwhelming star of that team, which is going into playoffs and being one of the more exciting watches. So I'm trying to figure out why his people put that on the back burner for so long. And now that he's just a guy, as you talked about, Floyd, where we pull this out of now.
Let me clarify, and thanks, Floyd, for giving me that clarification. As I said, I just didn't know how his play was. I always thought he was just an average player who made it to the NBA and then had that moment where he shined that really launched him into stardom. But knowing those facts about his career as a high school player, I will say I think that his ethnicity played a role in that. Now, his problems getting to the NBA, and he didn't make it, but I wonder how much of those stats at playing at Harvard were skewed in the mind of scouts. But I do think Ronnie brings up the bigger point here in that the timing of this is very interesting. If you want to make a statement about race, wouldn't have the time to have done it then when his star was the highest. So I don't know what they were trying to get at. And as we saw from the Accidental Racist song, any discussions on race are always difficult and need to be executed well. So I wonder what their planning was in this.
I would not be surprised if they had this piece on ice for a while and were planning to use it when he was having one of his hot streaks, because there's a lot of Houston Rockets footage in this as well. So it seems to me like perhaps they had this footage, they had this piece already produced, and he has this season with the Houston Rockets. He's having a good season, not a great season, and at some point, you can't wait for him to have a breakout moment, so you have to just run the piece whenever they have to run it. So I think it's almost a case of we have this piece on ice, and we might as well put it out. Well, guys, I think that's a great place to leave that part of the conversation. Let's play some music here on the Section 357 show. We'll be right back. Sit tight.
by the name of Lupe Fiasco, representing that first and 15. Yeah, and this one right here, I dedicate this one right here to all my homies out there grinding. You know what I'm saying? Legally and illegally. You know what I'm talking about? So, check it out. First got it when he was 6, didn't know any tricks. Matter of fact, first time he got on it, he slipped, landed on his hip and busted his lip. For a week he had to talk with a list like this. Now we can end the story right here, but shorty didn't quit, it was something in the air. Yeah, he said it was something so appealing, he couldn't fight the feeling, something about it. He knew he couldn't doubt it, couldn't understand it. Branded, since the first kickflip he landed, labeled a misfit, a bandit. Cocoon, 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 his neighbors couldn't stand his soul. He was banished to the park. Started in the morning, one stopped after dark. Yeah, when they said it's getting late in here, so I'm sorry, young man, there's no skating here. So we kick, push, kick, push, kick, push, kick, push, coast. And away he rolled, just a rebel to the world with no place to go. And so we kick, push, kick, push, kick, push, kick, push, coast. So come and skate with me, just a rebel looking for a place to be. So let's kick and push and coast.
Welcome back to the Section 357 show, where we always have the best beats in the house. Turning the page, going from a player who has had phenomenal success on a global level in basketball, turning that back to the NCAA and basketball as well. Ron, you mentioned the case of Marshall Henderson in our pre-show meeting when we talked about players and perceptions when it comes to guys who may have a questionable background or a checkered past or have at least overcome some obstacles and how they are perceived or treated in the media. So, Ron, can you please give our listeners some context as it relates to Marshall Henderson and his play and how that may relate to being an accidental racist?
If you watched the NCAA tournament, you saw Ole Miss, and their leading scorer was Marshall Henderson, a fiery character, to say the least. Shoots a lot of three-pointers, questionable shot selection, you know, very animated on the court, you know, talks trash to fans. But he's also a guy who's had a troubled background. 3 schools in 4 years, went from Utah to a junior college to Ole Miss, a couple of drug arrests. He's kind of been on the internet taking very frat boy type pictures with different co-eds, which is what college kids do. But as a star basketball player, he's been deemed as a rebel, not just because he plays for Ole Miss, but he's sort of seen as the rebel. And my question has been, he's also white. We've seen black athletes, college and pro, misbehave, questionable things on the internet, questionable past, arrest, and they are deemed a lot of time as a character issue. He was embraced, really, during the NCAA tournament as this sort of rebel, this fun guy. So, fellas, is this part and parcel with just being white, where you get a little bit of a pass on bad behavior off the court or off the field?
Ronnie, I don't know if it's a pass per se, but what I do notice is the questioning that gets done or doesn't get done by the media when you have characters like this. I mean, let's look at hockey, where fighting is embraced as a sport. And while you do have these players who are known as goons, you don't hear them talked about as being thugs. We saw a couple of very big fights that have happened recently in NASCAR. I mean, we're talking about fist fights between drivers. And while there are people who question perhaps the integrity of some of the drivers, what you don't get is this retrospective in the media about, you know, the influence of country music on NASCAR drivers, or, you know, how their habits growing up and the environment that they grew up in, how that affected who they are. And that is what I really see when you see a so-called thug of an athlete. You know, your Chris Johnsons, you start to get into, or your Steven Jacksons, in the NBA. They act up. All of a sudden, you get questions about, well, maybe is this, you know, a thug mentality or the hip-hop culture that you don't see for white athletes?
Ron and Dee, feel free to kind of disagree with me on this, but I think that in sports, and maybe even in life, that the masses affect how people treat the outlier. And Marshall Henderson, to me, is an outlier when it comes to white athletes in the NCAA, or I guess even in basketball in general. He is an outlier. So his transgressions are not the norm. So it's easier to focus on just his basketball and kind of give him a pass on some of his past transgressions. There's plenty of guys who have had questionable run-ins with the law, black players, that is, a lot of them. So, again, the outlier, the guy who doesn't get into trouble, the guy who is honor roll student, Phi Beta Kappa, et cetera, black athlete, does not get talked about as much. So I think that the outliers or the masses affect our perception of the outlier. And it just kind of goes with the territory in the media. So feel free to agree or come back at me on that.
I think there is something to that. I think because of the perception that black athletes are trouble, the white guy who is the outlier, whose past is just and questionable, the outlier is a good story. You know, if you look at college basketball this year, the personality wasn't there this year. Louisville, obviously, in Michigan was a great title game. The season as a whole was kind of a drag, kind of not too exciting. Marshall Henderson was like, hate him or love him, was something to talk about in this season. And because he was something to talk about, he's not seen as a troublemaker. He's not seen as a bad guy. He's seen as this he's eccentric. He's fiery. So there is to that outlier theory, Jay, and I think it's the same thing on the flip side with a Jeremy Lin. He's the outlier. He is different. We're not used to this, and what we're not used to becomes a good story, even if in other situations it's more common than we think.
I get your point in theory, Floyd. My problem is that this idea, this thought of the black athlete being a troublemaker is the norm and not the outlier, or that, you know, your great student athlete who's both good on the field and good in the classroom and not a troublemaker off the field, of that being an outlier, that perception is the problem. Because if you look at it in terms of numbers, there are far more good guys out there in sports than there are troublemakers. There are far more work duns or I don't know who else, you know, even Steven Jackson in the NFL is a person who I can think of who did a lot of good work in the St. Louis community. There are far more of those players than there are troublemakers. So it's the perception that black athletes being troublemakers is the norm, is the problem. But in execution, I agree with you.
Well, guys, I want to get you all's perspective on the actual accidental racist song, because not to go too far into depth with LL Cool J's lyrics, but from all the conversation that we heard, his verse really might be rapidly moving up the charts as one of the worst hip-hop verses ever. And Dee sent out an article from Ta-Nehisi Coates of The Atlantic that sort of talked about why LL Cool J was all wrong for this song to begin with, in terms of speaking about race. So just any general thoughts on the accidental racist song, LL Cool J's involvement in it, or LL speaking for black America, if you will? I don't know. How do y'all want to talk about that?
Real quick, the point of the Coates article was that if you wanted to get a rapper to talk about race, LL Cool J was not the rapper to do it. And the assumption that you can just get any black rapper to talk about race is the racism there, the assumption that we're all the same. But I do have to question what LL Cool J's motives are. I know he's kind of transitioned out of the rap game into a more mainstream TV and movie star. But at the same time, what made him think he could really have this good discussion about race in a rap song is not in his skill set. So I wonder if he was just looking to make a name for himself, or he started to think too highly of himself as a rap ambassador.
To be fair, I have not actually heard the song. I've only read lyrics. And from what I heard, I don't know how this advances any discussion on race relations in America. When you're using terms like relationship need a fixing between the Mason-Dixon and my personal favorite, if you don't judge my gold chain, I'll forget about the iron chain. I don't know how, even if you're trying to be controversial or trying to spark a conversation, how this brings any conversation. This to me, just smells like two dudes who had this idea and thought this was going to be, I think, almost funny in a way. And it's just not funny at all. And I don't get what it does. It's not even like a Public Enemy or a Guns N' Roses type situation where you could really say, okay, let's now talk about it after that. What is the conversation that this is supposed to spark? I'm not sure what it's supposed to do.
Well, guys, Last Call for Alcohol or something like it. D, what do you have?
My last call goes out to the Masters and Tiger Woods. Speaking about race, there was a lot of talk about Tiger back in the day being a black golfer and his multi-ethnic background, but I just want to say that I did enjoy watching the Masters this weekend. There was a lot of drama, a lot of different storylines, but having Tiger at or near the top of the leaderboard is just good for golf.
Last call for alcohol or something like it. Ron, what do you have?
The movie 42 about the life of Jackie Robinson. And while Jackie Robinson should be celebrated, of course, there's one person who gets forgotten in sort of race relations and business relations, and that's Curt Flood from Sunday's St. Louis Cardinals, Philadelphia Phillies. If you really wanted to talk about someone who really affected modern day sports as we know it, who doesn't really get talked about, Curt Flood. Look up the story of Curt Flood. It's as important to me as Jackie Robinson from not only the race side of it, but the money side of it. So big shouts out to Curt Flood, sort of a forgotten story, but nevertheless, a very important one. Floyd, take us home.
Ron, I think there's even a Curt Flood documentary that HBO put together a couple of years ago, so I'm not for certain on if it was HBO or Showtime, but I think it was HBO. I think there's a Curt Flood documentary that talks about his story and the things that he went through. As we still continue to discuss sports business, if you will, this has been a very big week for sports business as it relates to hip-hop, which is kind of the core of our show. So last week, we talked about Jay-Z's business dealings as it relates to the Brooklyn Nets and his switch over into the agency game. But Jay-Z, the rapper, kind of came out of left field with some words, some not-so-kind words for those who criticized both that deal as well as his recent trip to Cuba. So, again, Jay-Z doing what Jay-Z does, making headlines as usual. Also, Reebok decided to drop Rick Ross as a pitch man or a sponsorship partner, again, after some controversial lyrics. But this is, again, how sports and hip-hop do come together. And then a scenario that forces one to cut ties with the other. So with that being said, thanks to our fans out there. Check us out on Twitter, on Tumblr, on Podomatic, iTunes, Stitcher, and Apple Podcasts as well. And with that being said, good luck to you and your favorite sports teams out there, wherever you might be. This is the Section 357 show, where we always have the best seats in the house. Until next time, take care.